And welcome to another Pixel Drone Show episode. And we're really excited this week because it's a special episode. It's our 1 year anniversary. And who better to come back to the show than Romeo Durcher? We had Romeo when he first started at Otarian. And then a year later, as we're celebrating our 1 year anniversary, he's coming back to talk to us about all the cool things he's been doing at Otarian. My co-host is Kara Murphy and Haya Kestelo. You know them, you've seen them. Romeo, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, and a very happy anniversary, and congratulations, Kara, Greg, and Haya, for, you know, being here now a full year. I cannot even imagine that it's been a year since we talked last. What happened?
Yeah, too long.
Yes,
way too long.
You were one of our first guests on the show, and so you're the VP for public safety at Otarian. You guys do a lot of cool things, and we've talked actually about you in the show with other guests, which we'll get to in a minute. But can you tell us some of the highlights of the things you've been doing in the last year?
Yeah. Wow. Now thinking back, it feels like much longer than a year, but then on the other hand, it feels like just a few seconds. So much has happened last year. So at Otarian, we really focus on the open source, open standards approach. And we're not a drone manufacturer. We're an enabler. We're the software manufacturer. We're in essence creating the operating system that allows the end user to have, let's say, one user interface for a whole array of ecosystem solutions. So that can be multi-rotors from different manufacturers, that can be fixed-wing VTOLs from different manufacturers with different payloads on them. So it becomes that plug-and-play that, you know, maybe for this particular mission, I need this payload on that airframe, and it just all works together through our Otarian software solution stack. And that is such an exciting development, because in the drone industry, we have matured quite a lot over the last few years. Remember, in the beginning, everybody was just looking at specs of the drone, and mm-hmm. and then, you know, different payloads came onto the market. So you started to look at drone specs, payload specs, and today we're looking more about data and the data workflow. And to me, that's really maturity in our industry.
So Otarian is trying to standardize this this drone industry with all those individual standards that that different manufacturers use. You shared a video with us that we'll start playing right now. Can you talk us through what we're seeing in this video clip?
Yes, absolutely. So let's see if we wanna get this started. So this is really very fascinating, and you're all the first ones to see this. I kind of held this back. I wanted this to be on the special episode. So this is our Otarian standardization piece. And what we're seeing is Otarian mission control here on a ground station. So imagine you have your ground mm-hmm. controller, and now you have two vehicles. One of the vehicles is a fixed wing VTOL. The other one is a tricopter in this particular case. And what we're doing is we're in essence using one controller, one user interface, and we do multi-vehicle support. So now we're taking off with vehicle one. This is the fixed wing VTOL. It's the Quantum Systems vector platform, and it's taking off now. We're sending it into its orbit. So pretty much everything you do on a regular mission, nothing is different so far. So right now the system is flying into its designated orbit. Obviously, with fixed wing VTOLs, you don't hover in one place. You have continuous forward motion to really take advantage of that additional lift. So now we're adjusting the orbit. We want to get this ISR mission going. We're putting the platform into an orbit, and we're switching over to a thermal camera. And we're looking for, in this case, this individual. So we mm-hmm. found the individual on the thermal camera. We're holding on to this. And in the meantime, we are now launching the second vehicle. So this one is a tricopter. And While the original first VTOL mission is still operating, we're launching the second mission. We're putting it into the right altitude. And now we're controlling, in essence, multiple vehicles through one ground control station. So here we can see the tricopter. It's taking off. Obviously, it has a very different mission profile, the tricopter versus the fixed-wing VTOL. It's going into its own orbit. We can see on the left side here on the map how the VTOL is coming into the picture again, doing its orbit. And we're just controlling now these two platforms through one ground control station. So now we're you know, tracking this object that's hiding behind the tree. This object now is moving and it's being tracked. It's a typical ISR mission that we're conducting here. The very big difference is, yes, two different vehicles, two different flight patterns, two different flight operations in essence combined into one. And I think this is a really great example of what future multi-vehicle support really means. Now, obviously, there are regulatory restrictions in place right now, but that's, you know, we know that technology moves way faster than the regulatory environment can keep up with. But the fact that we can do this, we could have now a third vehicle, we could have a ground rover on the ground doing the same thing, you know, operating on through the same interface. And now you're starting to see the tremendous benefits of having things standardized across an ecosystem.
Yeah, essentially what you have is you have it's like having a drone with multiple payloads, but instead you're having multiple payloads on different drones that you can view from different angles. It's like switching angles in the middle of a flight. That's actually pretty impressive. My question would be, all these drones are from different manufacturers, but they have an Ortarian hardware inside as a commonality. Is that how it works?
Yes, you can kind of see it that way. This all operates on Ortarian's Skynode, and Skynode is the flight control, the autopilot. And in some vehicles, it's an actual physical hardware piece that's built in. In other devices, it's the reference design so that the manufacturer can build it themselves. But you're right, it's okay. A Pixhawk-based flight controller that runs our Ortarian system on it. And so over the last 12 months, since last time we spoke, we had five OEMs, five drone manufacturers using Ortarian Skynode. Today, we have over 100 manufacturers in different stages that wow. are using Ortarian's autopilot, in essence. And that is a tremendous increase, and it shows that the market understands and needs this standardization.
Yeah, that's tremendous growth since we last spoke. It's cool that you showed that video, because I think this kind of shows us that we have different ways that we can use not just drones, but even other automated equipment like rovers. What are some of the biggest challenges that you guys at Ortarian have run into trying to develop this? And you already mentioned the regulatory challenges, but I can imagine there must have been other challenges as well to make this work.
Yeah, look, there's outside challenges that we have, you know, a little input to in fixing, like regulations. That's not something that we can fix, but we can influence it. But then there's really the complexity, the challenges internally to make all of this work, because you want to do it right. You want to do the standardization and the ecosystem the right way. And that is a challenge. It's not an easy endeavor that we're embarking here with this, because it's, yeah, the focus right now, yes, is on drones, but we also have rovers that are already using Skynode, and you can switch from a drone now to the rover. So the ecosystem is increasing dramatically, and the options to the end users are increasing, and therefore the complexity of it all increases. And now our next focus is really on getting the data to where the user needs it in real time. And you may have heard me talk about the near death of the SD card. And I get a lot of slack for all of that. For good reason, because we're so attached to that SD card. And here is Romeo saying, get this attached from this SD card. And people have a hard time conceptualizing this. But the best perfect example is our smart device, where we take a picture and that picture immediately goes into our cloud, and we can now start processing it in Photoshop on an iPad or on our home computer without having to use an SD card. So the concept is not new, but for the drone industry, we've gotten so used of data transfer from an SD card to a laptop that people have a hard time understanding how could that actually work.
So I have a follow-up question for you then, Romeo. I mean, how important is the rollout of 5G mobile connectivity for Aterian in order to get rid of SD cards and be able to just transmit all the images and video footage right from the drone?
I mean, obviously, the more bandwidth and speed you have available, the more you can do. We already have it on 4G, and you can do a tremendous amount of real-time tasks, data transfer tasks. Obviously, with 5G and future, you know, 6G or whatever we will have, there will be even more of this. And it's absolutely needed. Think back. Some of us, we remember when computers first came to life in the business world. And I really remember I was doing my internship and we got computers. And the first computers were not really connected. They were connected internally with the office, but not with the outside world. And once they became connected, once the internet was part of all of this, this opened up tremendous more opportunities for how we're using computers. And the same is true for drones. Drones right now are not really connected. They're these standalone devices. And yeah, we do have some live stream capabilities, they're not really connected with each other. Now imagine we're connecting them all, and these two drones that we just saw in that video, they know where they are in space, and we share data between them and between the users and between the people that need the data. I mean, this is really where drones are going to make a tremendous impact in enterprise as well as in government work.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm kind of jumping ahead in our question bank. I had a question about a BVLOS network that is being developed here in the US. We talked to the director of the Northern Plains site last week about a network in North Dakota that they're building up to allow BVLOS flights. And a big reason why they're building this network of hardware on the ground is because 5G in certain areas is going to be difficult to get. You mentioned 5G and the importance of it. How does a network like what they're building in North Dakota fit into the picture? And is this something that you guys are considering, or are you really going to rely on the 5G network?
No, the beautiful thing about, you know, standardizing everything, it also means that you can open up ways of networking or integration. So it doesn't mean that you just have to stick to 5G. There are other ways that you can use and integrate your data exchange. Let's call it data exchange, because you're also sending, you know, telemetry information across that network. You're sending the payload data across the network, and you're sending commands potentially back and forth as well. So it doesn't mean that it's just 4G or 5G. There's a whole other array, including private networks for entities that say, look, we want to build our own private network. So we have full control over it, and there's plenty of solutions out there. And so we can also integrate the drones into that network. And that is really the big, big, big benefit of open standards.
I remember, I think a couple of years ago, you gave a presentation about how you guys process all the data and the photos that you collected from the campfire in Paradise, California. Yeah. And how that was such an incredible hassle to get all those SD cards offloaded, processed, and it was like tens of thousands of images. Can you talk about that and how that would be different, let's say, with more modern equipment and a platform like Aterian's?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we do have to be honest that every time we have a disaster, we do lose a lot of capabilities because of the disaster. So your power may be down, your communications may be down because these communications towers either burned down or had damage to it, or if it's a storm, they may have been, you know, broken. So there's always the challenge in natural disasters that you have your surrounding is highly impacted. However, we have our network companies like AT&T and Verizon. They quickly can bring in equipment to establish connectivity again. And once that connectivity is back up, which usually takes, you know, maybe a day or two, now you can start implementing all of these solutions where you can send data back and forth. Or you build your own private network, which has become so much easier. I mean, there are solutions that work out of a backpack where you get, you know, a mile, 2 mile range, and now you extend that and suddenly you have, let's say, a five square mile range. You can do a lot of operations on a private network in a 5 square mile area, and your data gets transferred over that private network, and you eliminate that need of an SD card.
So lightening it up a little bit, earlier this year, you were in Western Europe flying some rather large drones in the mountains, just in these gorgeous landscapes. I'm very jealous, but I'm wondering if you could talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, and how timely all of this is. You know, what's happening in the Ukraine is something that most of us never imagined we would see in our lifetimes. You know, less than 100 years after World War II, I thought, you know, we would have learned our lessons, and yet here we are again. And I was in Estonia in late last year, working with Estonian entities on really the future of drone integration. And Estonia shares a border with Russia, and obviously the Estonian Border Patrol has always had interest also in protecting their borders and having oversight. And other forces within Estonia, like the fire and police service, they're also wanting to better integrate drones. And I think what we have really learned over the last couple of months is how important, again, the standardization piece is. Because if you have a piece of technology that needs to go somewhere quickly, but people first have to learn how to use it, it's very likely not going to make a big impact immediately or at all, because you just don't have the time to train people on all these different technologies. So the fact that we have this understanding now is really helping the entire industry to focus on the standardization. And then obviously also, you know, this new technology, especially drones, they need to operate in harsh environments. It's easy to fly a drone in the beautiful sunny California environment, but it's a whole different ball game when you have to operate in very cold conditions. And so these platforms need to be tested, not only the hardware, but then also how the software integration works and how all of this plays together and where do we need to do improvements. So that was a lot of my visits to Central as well as Eastern Europe over the last several months. And this will continue because these are also really, really great learning opportunities for the industry.
Yeah, and speaking of that, you wrote an article about farming and the use of drones. And I know you were, that was in February, I think, and you were talking about a project that you were working on in Ukraine. Ukraine, I think a lot of people don't realize, have a ton of resources that produce a lot of, it's a big agriculture for the world, actually. And you were hoping to use drones there to help with the farming and everything. Can you talk about this project and obviously how maybe it's been impacted with what's going on in Ukraine now?
Yes. Ukraine has tremendous farmland. And, you know, it's Eastern Europe in general, there is so much great technology being developed. Drones that we don't even talk about here in the United States, small manufacturers in Estonia and Latvia and Lithuania that are developing some really incredible systems and software solutions that we here just don't really hear about. So if you ever have an opportunity to do a show on, you know, Eastern European drone companies, boy, yeah. I think it would be so fascinating. But yes, reality is, you know, drones in agricultures, that's nothing new. We've been talking about this for 5, 6, 7 years. But the real challenge is, you know, the farmer is a trained farmer. The farmer should not be somebody that offloads data, has to analyze data to just then understand what it really means. A farmer needs to have technology that does what technology does best and gives him or her, in essence, a short overview or recommendation and potentially the ability to autonomously do the next steps. Now it becomes very, very helpful to this farmer. So if we want to look at it at an example, if this farmer has a drone that he says, okay, I want once a week, I want this drone to fly over my field, do a mapping, look for areas that have potentially, you know, too much water, not enough water, other issues, and then give me the results and allow me to maybe press a button and send another autonomous device to take care of these issues. So if it's an area that has not enough water, well, maybe there is a drone that just goes and sprays that area, or maybe it's an autonomous watering system, robotic watering system that just goes to that area and takes care of the problem. Or if it's pesticide that it will ship there by drone and just treat that particular area. Now we're starting to add value because the farmer doesn't have to do the analyzation of data, doesn't have to manually fly, and has this arsenal of technology available while he can continuously do the other tasks that a farm, you know, brings. And that's in essence what the future has to be like. And you see the trend. It's really not necessarily about the hardware. It's about the data. What does the data tell us? And how can we use the data to do the next step, initiate the next step? And if that next step is autonomously done as well, boy, that is tremendous value added.
Sounds like there's a lot of innovation coming to farming in the near future. And talking about innovations, not too long ago, we spoke to Bobby Watts from Watts Innovations, an American drone manufacturer, and there aren't many. So whenever we get a chance to talk to one of those guys, that's always super exciting. Bobby Watts told us about the partnership between Watts Innovations and Otarian. Can you tell us more about that partnership and why Otarian and the platform is so important for Bobby Watts' drones?
Look, Bobby and his team, they're just incredible and amazing. And I just flew, you know, the Prism Sky last mm-hmm. week, and it's such a beautifully designed aircraft. It's just massive and it's done so well. And now Bobby has become part of the Otarian ecosystem. And, you know, if you are a drone manufacturer, you have to really get it right. There is not, today, it's not like you have several tries to get it right. You got to get it right from the beginning. It has to perform.
Oh, yeah.
And it's complex. And you know, the flight control, the brain of the drone, the flight controller, the software, why should every manufacturer have to design all of that themselves when you can use a standardized, you know, approach and go to market quicker, have, you know, something that works and means more flexibility also to your end users. I mean, there are so many great benefits to becoming part of an ecosystem. And Bobby and his team, they are a fantastic example of taking the technology that we provide, doing a design, a concept, testing it, and then seeing, oh yeah, this really works. This is exactly what we would like, and then getting it into production in a very, very short period of time. So exciting.
And just for people who are listening to understand, even big companies like Autel Robotics and DJI have issues with bringing their products to market without any flaws. So I can only imagine what a partnership with Aterion means for a smaller drone manufacturer like Watts Innovations.
It's fantastic to do that, because at the end of the day, the end user gets more choices. You know, if we have two different platforms and five different payloads that they can put on those different platforms, swap and change around. I mean, that flexibility is so helpful to end users.
Yeah, totally. Do you have any sense of how much faster, let's say, Watts Innovations can bring their drones to market when they're using a platform like Aterion versus having to develop everything themselves? Or is it hard to say?
It's hard to say, but you know, we're talking about months and enhanced capabilities as well. It's not just, you know, cutting down time, but even more capabilities, like having that full integration of health data. And that's so important. Like, you want to know how healthy is your drone, how healthy is your operations. And you want to know that in real time, if possible. And so all of this additional data points that we provide are tremendously helpful for manufacturers, but then extremely helpful for end users.
So since being at Aterion, who are some of the most fascinating people and or companies that you have met along the way?
There are many. Bobby and Watts Technologies is certainly one of them for many different reasons, including the mindset, the vision, how they put the vision into action and have a product available so quickly. To me, that's super exciting. But then there's also others. You know, we're seeing more and more fixed wing VTOL. Interest and demand and options, and you know, from your quantum systems to Avi to many others, and I'm excited about this because I've been wanting to have VTOL being used more in public safety and in enterprise, and so it's exciting to see that these are now more and more coming online. But then also, and we just announced a couple of partnerships the last week or two. Elsight is providing drone connectivity solutions that we are now including in our ecosystem. And their product Halo runs connections with different carriers at the same time. So bonded cell phone in essence. And to me, that is very fascinating because that's exactly where we want to go in the future with these connected devices that use, you know, multiple inputs or highways, data highways in essence, whatever is available, whatever has the least amount of traffic. And that to me is super exciting. Gramsci is a camera gimbal stabilization manufacturer for drones. And they have been deeply integrating into our ecosystem and part of our Mavlink standardized connectivity platform. And just, you know, seeing all these different entities become part of a larger ecosystem, super, super fascinating.
So you stated in a recent interview that open source is the future for drones. Can you elaborate on this stance a little bit more?
Yes. You know, coming from the proprietary system world, even a year into the open source world, this is still sometimes mind-boggling to me, when in reality, it actually shouldn't, because open source has been around for, you know, couple decades almost. And we see it, Red Hat and Linux, it's a perfect example where open source has become a real amazing enterprise tool. And what open source really is instead of just you know, one team working on something, you have people across the globe contributing to the software stack. And that is tremendously impactful because our community, our PX4 community, that's 10,000 developers that are contributing. So if there's an issue and we need a solution, there's potentially 10,000 people that can work on that. So you're much more agile, you're much more quicker, you have a community approach. You know, you see the code, you can evaluate the code, you can test the code, and you can also see any sort of issues that come across. So you're much more powerful in maintaining this code. And then companies like Autarian, we take this open source code and we put it into a format that is, you know, more user-friendly. Because, you know, developers don't necessarily understand or should have the understanding how a drone is being used in the field by a certain entity. That's where we come in. We kind of make that initial source code, that open source software, to what it should look like for the end user. And that's the value add that Autarian brings to it. But really, it's the open source community. It's amazing to follow their enthusiasm and you know, their developments. It's super, super, super fascinating. And it's in my opinion, really, it unifies the drone industry. There's just no other way to express it.
Yeah. I want to talk about BV loss a little bit because it's a hot topic in the US and actually pretty much anywhere in the world at the moment. The Aviation Ruling Committee released a report or recommendations, I should say, a couple of weeks ago. And there were some pretty interesting nuggets in there. I'm sure you've been following this. Was there anything in the report that you find different that you think is there's ideas that maybe are worth noting?
I didn't dig too deep into it, to be frank, only because we are seeing good developments in this whole BV loss space, but we're also, you know, sometimes lagging in just getting stuff rolled out. And by that, I mean, we don't need to roll stuff out across the United States in a non-controlled manner, but we got to do more. We got to enable more test areas and test sites and more entities to be part of this whole BV loss structure and what it should look like. But overall, I think we're making fairly good progress, and it's encouraging to see. It's also encouraging to see that it's not just happening in the United States, it's happening across the globe. And I think that's where we have to be mostly cautious about, because it cannot be that we have one way of dealing with BV loss here versus a different way somewhere else. Then we have the exact same issues as we had with regulations, where certain areas of the globe had very, very different types of regulations initially, or no regulations. And we've become a little bit more standardized. But this got to be a global undertaking.
Yeah. And that's a tough one, right? To get all those regulations to be the same across the world. I mean, it's hard already between, let's say, Canada, the US and Europe, let alone the other countries. Now, one of the recommendations in the ARC report was for manned aviation, so regular airplanes and helicopters that do not have ADS-B on board, when they fly below 400 feet, they would have to give way to drones, which is totally new because drones, of course, always have to give way to manned aviation. What do you think about a recommendation like that, where the drones actually get right of way, if you will?
I think it's very applicable because, you know, if we talk about crewed aviation, you still have this individuals on the controls, and that individual has the ability to take action much quicker than an uncrewed vehicle, potentially. Unless, you know, you really have highly integrated software and AI that can help mitigate. But right now, to me, this makes pretty sense as long as crewed aviation has all the information of where are these other platforms and what are their flight path, what are their projected flight paths, so that they can take this mitigative action To me, it makes sense. It's a huge change in, like you said, Hai, in how we have been dealing with crewed aviation from a drone operator perspective, because we always had to give way to the incoming helicopter. And potentially this is going to change. And it's quite fascinating. But it also shows the importance that is being put on these uncrewed vehicles.
Yeah.
Yep. So you mentioned the integration of information or the sharing of information between manned aircraft and unmanned aircraft. At the moment, we're not there because it would require additional equipment on board of a manned aircraft. Especially in the U.S., we cannot use ADS-B out on drones to share that information with manned aircraft. What's the solution? You have an open source system. Is this something that you guys are looking into as well, so that there is an integration not only between unmanned aircraft that are flying, but also providing that information to manned aircraft so that
That's not something visible. That we specifically are looking into, but there's entities out there that are, and that goes from NASA with their UTM project to other entities that are in a much better position to think this through. And when you look at open source and who is developing on open source, NASA is a perfect example of space projects that are based on open source, and also ground missions or Earth missions that are, including open source. So to me, this would be a fantastic entity to take this on, and they are to some degree, so that we have easier ways of integrating. If we go, imagine if we were to do this piece in a closed system, in a proprietary system, and everybody would be locked into this company, and you could only use that one company's solution, that would be extremely dangerous. Dependency would go up. If something ever happened to the company, you would lose an entire system. So it cannot be that way. That would be the worst outcome.
Yep.
Okay, poor Ethan is going to have his work cut out for him with me today. So how do you see the evolution of BVLOS in Europe versus the US? Who do you think is ahead and why?
I haven't really focused too much on the developments on the BVLOS side to really make a good determination who's in front and who's doing it better. To me, it's important that we are tackling this, on a larger scale, that it's not just, an FAA running with this, that this is really a community approach, that stakeholders are part of it, and that we try to do it right. Trying to do it right always means more time. And at some point, you just have to say, okay, we got to evaluate what we have now and see what works, what doesn't work, where can we improve, what needs to change, and continue working on it. And this is going to be an evolutionary process. Whatever we come up with is not the final thing. It's going to change over time because, again, of technology that comes to market, of different ways of integrating data and all of that. So I couldn't give you a good answer on who's ahead and who's doing it better. To me, it's important that we are looking into this and we're taking this serious. And we're putting also pressure on the regulatory body that it gets done, because the industry is ready. The end users are ready. There is so much that can be done. And we're just waiting for a proper framework to start integrating all of it.
Yeah. And speaking of that, we've seen companies such as Wing doing flights in Australia. We've seen Zipline testing things in Africa, where obviously the regulation is not nearly as stringent. Is this something that you have experience, and have you considered going to other countries to test some of your products where maybe things are a little bit easier?
Mostly for hardware manufacturers, always a great way to go to areas where they can, easier test things. And obviously, you already make a big impact in Africa with deliveries, because you have vast areas that you need to cover. And, you know, what Zipline is doing, what Wing is doing, it's super exciting, and they're doing it at scale. And that's the big piece. You know, it's one thing to do 10 flights and then you have a test, you have results. That's great. But if you're doing thousands of flights, hundred thousands of flights, that is just incredible.
Yeah. I mean, what Jeff Bezos famously said in 2013 that drone delivery was going to be a routine occurrence in 5 years' time from Amazon. And clearly that hasn't happened. We're almost 10 years down the road since he said those infamous words. What do you think the big holdup has been, or the big restriction has been, when it comes to delivering items with drones?
Well, you know, you always have to see what financial benefit does it do. You know, if a retail chain starts doing drone delivery, is it really scalable to them? And by scalable, it means it cannot just be one location. It has to be rolled out to, you know, multiple of their locations, hundreds of their locations. And does it really save time and money? And if all of these check out, then you have a very, very good case of drone delivery. And obviously, it's an easy, you know, easy calculation to say, okay, if I can transport something from the valley up to the mountain and I can use the drone, that makes a lot of sense, because it would take, you know, an hour and a half to get up on the mountains. Now it only takes 15 minutes. That's an easy one. But it gets a little bit more complex when you're in an urban environment and you say, hey, you know, this grocery store is a mile away from my house, and my home is in a four-story building. And now, you know, how complex is this delivery? How much time is really being saved versus me going and picking it up there, or they having a driver drop it off here? So the fact that we are working on urban deliveries and planning for a scale out is super exciting. But it's not as easy as, you know, delivering medicine in Africa over 30 miles across, you know, a big valley. It's very, very different.
Yeah, we had this discussion with Bill Wimberly from Wingcopter a couple months ago, and I think we were all in agreement that the B2B and the B2C are two different markets. Bringing the drone directly to the customer is a lot more difficult to do, and we've seen divided opinions on this, but I think we're all of us on this call, plus a bunch of other people in the industry, agree with that. What's your take on this, B2B, business to business, or are we going to go from a business to customer directly? Well, what's viable and what's
not? We oftentimes talk about the last mile, and the last mile usually is a B2C. And the last mile is a real challenge. What we don't often talk about is the first mile. And the first mile could make sense. Let's say a very congested downtown area, where you just need to get stuff out to a distribution center. So from there, it can go by truck to different areas. So that by itself could already be a much better approach, but it's still B2C initially. But where I really think the potential is B2B. But that also means that we will have larger systems with higher payload capabilities, because we're oftentimes needing a much denser volume to be sent from point A to point B.
So what is one of your recent favorite drones for good use cases?
I just judged round two of the AirWards award. And this is the second year AirWards is around. And I can't give you too many details, but there were some really good drones for good use cases. And, you know, we're seeing, I mean, on the public safety side, there's no more question. Is this really something that's going to stay? That has been put to bed. We're seeing public safety use cases daily now from all over the world, where drones are making a big impact. We're seeing more and more humanitarian missions that are being done by drone. And obviously your UN and UNDP and World Food Programs, they have fantastic drone programs and really great use cases. We're also seeing more being done in, you know, animal rescues. And I think that's always, you know, something that touches my heart when we see these fantastic use cases where drones are helping, you know, animals either after a disaster or even in nature where, you know, certain type of information helps protect animals. And to me, that's just a fantastic use case. So more and more we're seeing these drones for good, or what I like to call UAVs for good use cases. And it's spectacular.
Yeah, I cover quite a few of those stories on Drone Excel, and I'm always amazed by how effective those drones are in those kind of situations versus the more traditional search party approach that are often used. Of course, a lot of people know that you now work for Otaria, and I think a lot of people also know that you used to work for a Chinese drone manufacturer called DJI. Since you are very familiar with that culture, I was wondering if you perhaps can shine some light on the recent Mavic 3 drone launch from DJI. It seems to us, at least, that they rushed the launch to get it out into the stores before the fourth quarter, then followed up with firmware updates to basically release some of the features that were promised to come with the drone, and they're still having issues. I don't recall ever having seen a DJI drone launch that was facing this many issues. Do you have any idea what might have happened there?
Look, we always had this kind of struggle to get, you know, product out as quickly as possible. In the early days, it was to, you know, beat the competition. You know, going back 7 years or so, you wanted to get it out before, you know, GoPro put their new drone out. And so you would do these type of things knowing that it's not perfect yet, and a lot of the fixes can come with software. So the whole concept is nothing new. But what has happened is the drone industry has matured, and the consumer market has matured, and the expectations have increased quite dramatically. And so you got to get a product out that, you know, does what you advertise to do, potentially, you know, in day one when you buy that thing, because DJI has a big consumer fan base. People want to get their Mavic 3 drone with amazing camera specs, and they want to do all these cool things. If they now have to wait weeks or months for software updates to come, it's a little outputting. I am not surprised, because this has always been the culture. I am surprised, however, that maturity piece has not yet happened, and not just DJI, but other, you know, Asian drone manufacturers. And that is kind of surprising, because they should know by now the market. They should know the consumer expectations. Mm-hmm. And that is a little bit troubling to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine that Apple would come with a new iPhone 14 and then half the features don't work and they're going to fix it with an update. I mean, that just, people wouldn't accept that. And I think, in the drone world, we're at that point too, that we don't accept it anymore. I mean, people weren't happy with the Mavic 2 Pro when it first was launched, when it came to video recording quality. Now with the Mavic 3, it's a bigger issue. And you would think that after so many years, they got that stuff together, but we're not quite there yet, unfortunately. And as you mentioned, it's not just DJI. I mean, Autel has issues with their product launches as well. So, but anyway, Kara, I think you have a question for Romeo as well here.
I sure do. So as we know, DJI has lost some key people in the past year or so, including you. Brendan Schulman comes to mind. What do you think the long-term implications of those losses are going to be for the company?
Look, there are two answers to this. Obviously, my personal, the way I want to feel is I want to feel that I had an impact. And so, of course, I want to think that me leaving also had an impact. Reality is everybody is, you know, replaceable to some degree in the short term. But in the long term, it may really leave a void. And that's not necessarily now me, but for example, a Brandon Schulman was extremely, extremely important for us at DJI. You cannot put into a dollar amount the importance he had by, you know, working with the FAA, by working with lawmakers, by ensuring that we are doing things that are seen positively at a time where it was extremely crucial for the drone industry to do it right, like, you know, geofencing, for example, and ADS-B implementation. Those were, you know, things that DJI was really behind pushing. And that was because of Brandon. And so people like that are extremely important. And we are seeing some of these issues because DJI has lost stability, has lost some of the older folks that have said, hey, you know, this is the way we need to do it. We can't always rush to market. We can't always do this and that. Let's become more mature. That is being felt. But reality also is that, sadly, most of us are replaceable. And that's just how it is. And a company needs to be, you know, nimble enough. If heaven forbid, if I die in an airplane crash, you know, somebody should be able to pick up what I have done. They may do it differently, but you cannot have dependencies on individuals. That's also dangerous. But DJI did lose a lot of good people for various reasons, including, you know, my reason of wanting to do a bigger vision that is so much more needed than what we were doing. And it's felt in the drone industry. But luckily, you know, Brandon is still in robotics. What he's doing with Boston Robotics is fantastic. Most of us that have left DJI are still in the drone industry. So the industry as a overall is not losing out. That's the good news.
Yeah. And single points of failure are dangerous in a company, but when you have multiple points of failure because multiple people leave, that can be pretty drastic as a result, like you said. I'm wondering, you know, DJI has been taking a lot of punches in the last 2 years from a regulatory standpoint in the US. Do you think with these departures, it's a sign that DJI may not be as interested into the American market, especially where you guys are? You were in the public safety department, and Brandon was more on the regulatory side of things. Do you think DJI might be pulling back from the US to concentrate on other markets?
Look, right now, I have no knowledge of any such developments. I don't think that is the case, because we saw, you know, the latest, what they really catered to the public safety drone that DJI released. A lot of the features were exactly the ones that I had been pushing before. So it's good that these things are coming to market, because they help our first responders do their jobs better. And ultimately, it helps us as everyday civilians. So I don't think they're thinking that way. But it's also reality that they have lost market share. And that is because others are coming and others are doing things a little bit differently. And that is good, because it creates a much more healthy environment. Competition is good, especially for the end users. So I am not too worried that DJI will say, okay, we're not going to focus on certain markets. And if they do, well, then it gives opportunities for even more other manufacturers to step in, and they are. Some of them are truly stepping in.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. Competition is really good for all of us. So I want to talk about, I want to wrap it up, actually, because we're getting on the hour here. And I know we can go and talking forever. I love having you as a guest. You're so insightful, and you've been around for such a long time. It's great. But what are we talking about in 12 months for a 2-year anniversary? What's in the pipeline
that we should AUVSI be excited about? AUVSI is around the corner. I hope. Are any of you coming to AUVSI?
We all should be there. Yeah.
Please, please, please come by, say hello. We have a nice big booth. I think it's 2529. It's our booth number. So AUVSI this year will be in Orlando, Florida. It's only almost like 6-7 months since the last time we met at Exponential. Exponential last year was in August, so it's not been a full year. And
I won't be there.
No.
I know. I got to pay taxes and I'm going to an astro class the beginning of May. Kind of poor timing. But maybe I can swing something. We'll see. We'll see how bad the taxes are. I'm still working on them.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we have multiple announcements. You know, AUVSI, Exponential, a lot of entities are placing their PR announcements around that time. So I think across the industry, you will see some exciting announcements come out, including Autarian. In fact, we started already because we have so many that we said, okay, we're going to start a couple, 3 weeks before AUVSI starting to release all these different partnerships and developments. Our booth is really showing our ecosystem. You know, we want to celebrate this ecosystem of entities that come together, and our focus is going to be on autonomous mobility and what the future of the industry will look like. We will also do a lot of live interviews and presentations from our booth, kind of like not talking about our solutions, but the greater ecosystem. And I think that is exciting because so many companies do great things, but they don't get the face time enough. People don't really get to hear or see what some of these entities are doing. And we want to give them a platform at our booth to showcase what they're doing in the industry. So hopefully, if you are going to Exponential, please come by, check it out. And Greg and Kaye, if you guys are coming by, let's meet at our booth and have a little chat. Oh, yeah.
Sounds good to me.
Sounds really, yeah. I'll try.
Yep. Please, Carl. Yes, that would be lovely. I don't think we've met in person, have we? No.
I don't think so. No.
No.
I don't think so.
We also have never
met these guys in person either.
We have never
flown. I need to change that.
Yeah, you do. And we've never flown together.
Oh, we have. You and
yeah,
I?
Yeah.
No? Okay. Probably years ago.
Have we? Where?
Oh, gosh. No. You know what? It's all.
But I, you know,
I'm trying to think Inner Drone or something, but I don't know.
Yeah, it could be. It's hard to keep track of it all. But I've been seeing all your aerial artwork, and lately you've been just knocking it out of the park left and right.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that. I have more planned, kind of looking to step up to the next level, collaborate with some new people that I've met in the NFT space, but. When I get time to edit it, my friend Rich was my visual observer, but he had me do a full over with the Mavic 3 of Hancock Tower. And the tallest point of the tower is 1,500 feet, and the Mavic 3 goes up to 1,620. So I flew right over those antennas. And that'll be a little clip. I'll get around to it hopefully this next week, but pushing the limits.
Awesome.
I appreciate it.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap it up. Romeo, I can't thank you enough for joining us. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show. We put new episodes every Tuesday. Leave your comments as well on YouTube. We love interacting with you. Romeo, thanks again. And we'll see you in a few weeks, hopefully in Orlando. And then if not, we'll see you in 12 months.
Thank you so much for having me on the anniversary show. Congratulations again. Keep it up. Your work is very important for the industry, for end users alike, as you know, us manufacturers on hardware and software, bringing us all together. So thank you for all that effort.